How are you doing? What's really sweet is that you have two solid days of practice behind you. And some of you are new to retreat. So 2 days can feel like 2 weeks. The just mere adjusting to coming on retreat, the digital detox that we have to do, the letting go of the many projects that arise in our minds. I hope you can feel the luxury. It is an incredible luxury that we can sit together and have this space where you really could actually let go of all your projects to just be and be on this land. We're so lucky. And so I know it can feel like a slog. And in checking in with a lot of you today, I just was struck by how many of you just said the support of this land is so powerful for you. And if you're new to retreat, this is the easiest way to do retreat, to come on nature retreat in a place that's just, I mean, I'm just so in love with this land. And, you know, the more you come back here, the more in love you fall. And we're just so lucky to be on this land. And, you know, in our meditation of listening to the silence of the earth, when I was eating and just looking at this big space, I mean, it's almost like from a painting or something, just sundown and the cliffs across from sundown is just so sort of almost iconic, isn't it? But I literally was just listening to the huge space of silence and could not hear a human sound. Wow. So I'm really glad that this land is teaching you and speaking to you and sort of people whispering you. And this is something I never say on a day-long retreat. The hardest day of retreat is the first day. Not a good thing to say on a day long. It's just so much to adjust to. And then the second day, as some of you all are saying, you know, you are much more adjusted. So yay. You can feel good about your good effort. This is a wholesome force in the world that you're actually willing to come and be silent with no distraction, no way to manage your experience except to be in it. And we could really say, in addition to injustice as a root cause of violence, another root cause of violence is the inability to be with ourselves and be with our experience. We have to do something sometimes aggressive because our experience is so intense. And so what we're doing is a gift to the world. It's a gift to us, but, you know, we will, without trying, take back into the world, you know, more peace and more clarity, more kindness, more awareness. So this retreat, you know, we're doing it not just for us, but, you know, I don't want to sound all grandiose about it, but it's true, we're doing it for the world, because who we are is contagious. What we learn inside is contagious. it's so contagious. You know, the Buddha sat down and figured out what really made him suffer and what helped him be free of suffering. That's so powerful and impactful. And he went off on his own and did it. But then he brought it back, and it's so powerful what he discovered that it's here with us, you know, 2,500 years later in this room. Why? Because it works. My personal belief and prejudice is that the Buddha gave us the keys to the universe and made it so simple. And there's other ways, there's other keys. But this key, you know, is the one that has worked for me. The two keys, you know, everything boils down to awareness and love. If we can keep practicing awareness and love, and from love comes care and then action and, you know, work in the world to help the world be a more just and better place. So I don't want to just say, you know, it's just sitting here and feeling awareness and love. It's bringing that into the world. But that is, it's just so simple. We could boil down to the Dharma as be aware of this moment and be kind. Dalai Lama says, my religion is kindness. And here's a guy so smart, he never wears it on his sleeve, but he got his PhD in Tibetan Buddhist philosophy, his Geshe degree, when he was 16. And he could tell you all about the 33, you know, forms of emptiness. But then he just, it's that simple. So we're doing a good thing, even if it feels like a slog. And like Dave, you were saying last night, sometimes a hard retreat, you don't even know it, but something really worthwhile is happening. Because even when it's hard, we're confronting something in our hearts, you know, that's unclear or confused or twisted. And Dharma, bringing awareness and love to that, helps our karmic knots untie by themselves. The simple act of paying attention moment by moment cultivates our own Buddha heart, our own heart of awareness and love. So, be glad. And a lot of you, you know, are really connecting with the land and are glad, and it's a slog. And I just, you know, I always like to try to lighten things up a little bit because life is hard. Dharma practice is hard. Retreat is hard. Sitting with my sorry mess of a mind and a heart is hard. And I've been practicing a long time. And, you know, Ram Dass is quoted as saying, I haven't lost a single one of my neuroses, you know, in all these years of practice. But I'm much kinder to myself. And so big whoop, we're neurotic. Who cares? Yeah, I'm a neurotic mess. So what? You know, I'm supposed to be a Dharma teacher and been teaching 20 years and practicing 30 years and, you know, went to Asia and temporarily ordained for 4 months. Like, big whoop. All that matters always is being here right now with things just as they are and bringing in love. And you can take this till your dying breath. My father died on April 27th. And I was with him for his last breath. And this is not his path. When I told him, after trying to help him understand what meditation was, I finally said, you know, Dad, it's just really about sitting there and doing nothing. Dad is like, well, that just goes about against everything I've ever learned in my life. I'm like, I know, Dad. I know. But life is so uncertain and so full of flow. And I've attended the death of both my mom 5 years ago and now my dad this year. And every single step of the way was a total mystery. Even when we had hospice workers with us, with my dad, you know, and they could say, today's pretty much the day, and I got the call. I had my parents, my dad and my stepmom live in Charleston, South Carolina, and I had been there 3 times in April, and, you know, I had flown back to Colorado and worked a few days, knowing I was probably going to come back any time. And Wednesday morning, I got the call from my stepsister. It's time. So, you know, we all 5 kids just traveled to be there. We got there. I got there at midnight, and my dad was still alive. And so we had the day with him. And I had just had a good connection with him the weekend before. So nothing was left undone or unsaid. And, you know, my dad's path was Christianity, so I would sit at his bedside and read him prayers from his prayer book, and he would just thank me and just tell me he needed to be reminded of that. It's one of the last things he said to me. And we still didn't know. We just didn't know when Dad was going to die. And again, you know, some of the helpers were saying, you know, it's soon. And we kind of had an inkling in the last hour that this was really close. And so, you know, we were all by his bedside, and my stepmother was just trying to orient him and tell him how much she loved him, and he could go, and this was his time. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, my dad was just completely non-responsive, you know, for the last 3 days, really just 2 days. But then suddenly my dad opened his eyes. I don't know where he got the strength for this. He couldn't even move in his bed. He propped himself up on his elbows and he roared. And we're just like, what? He's just like, oh! I mean, it was just more, it was like from the depth of his soul. And he stopped and he roared again. And then he died. And that was his last breath. And my brother and I, we looked at each other and we had the exact same thought. One of us said it, I don't remember who. He was gathering his strength. And that's what it felt like. It just felt like wherever he was going, he needed to come out of that slumber and just, it was like, you know, kind of a warrior's proclamation almost. And I said to my brother, that was magnificent. Which, and he's like, he later said, you said it was awesome. I'm like, I didn't say awesome. I said magnificent. And it's different. It's not awesome. Like, go, dude, awesome. was not. It was magnificent. It was like a lion just proclaiming, you know, his journey, wherever it's taking him. And every step of the way, it was just totally mysterious. My mom didn't die anything like that. That's the way my dad did it. It was very surprising. And we, you know, we had a really good relationship. And, you know, it's the rare father who can die with his three boys and two stepdaughters uniformly adoring him. One of my stepsisters even said he was my real father. So, did I say something about lightening up? I had no plans whatsoever to talk about this, but it's just what came. And awareness and love, we can take right up to our last breath, and that's what Dad took, you know. We sent him off with love, and it was the love that he had given us just coming right back to him. And my stepmother, who's not at all, you know, interested in meditation or anything, but it was very cute. She just said to me, "Peter, this is, you know, a few, 10, 20 minutes before he died, would you say something Buddhist?" I'm like, okay, let me see. Let me pull out. No, sutta. Oh, yeah. How about I give him the sutta on the five aggregates. Just kidding, no, I will not do that. I said, you know what, Dad, wherever you're going, I have no idea, but it's going to be a good place because you've put so much good in this world. And your good works follow you. Don't be scared. That's just what came to me, because he just put so much love and courage, you know, into the world. Yeah, I guess this all came from me saying, you know, awareness and love are the keys to the universe. Literally, if you could just really put into action this practice of knowing what's happening right now, it's just so simple, right? So just check in. What sensations obvious in your body? Just feel it. That's all you have to do. That's the path. Do that enough times, and you discover your own true Buddha heart. And remember to be kind, and, you know, being generous, and fighting for justice. You know, there's many things. But all of that comes from awareness and love. So you can't go wrong. And I don't know if Dad heard his last breath, but we sure did. But he definitely was in a place of love. And even though his body was completely falling apart, that's what remained. So, it is kind of funny what we do, isn't it? the teacher Ajahn Chah, when he came to IMS, Insight Meditation Society, and the Burmese style of walking meditation is super, super slow. We haven't really taught you that. But at IMS, if you've ever done retreat there, you know, during walking meditation, there's like 80 people on the lawn, just super slow walking. Ajahn Chah, you know, revered, one of the main teachers of Joseph and Jack and Sharon. You know, he came up to the center and was like, "I've come to the loony bin. Why is everyone in slow motion?" And then, do you ever notice all the places your mind goes to on retreat? Like, we've lost all of our, you know, entertainment, so our mind just decides to take over. And back in my former career as a scientist and wildlife biologist, I spend the better part of a day on a 2-month retreat at Spirit Rock composing the history of the earth in powers of 10. So the last 10 days, and then 100 days, and then 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years. And I've been reading all this evolutionary psychology and history, and I was enthralled. It's like I could do that just on retreat. But then your mind, you know, it gets hung up on really meaningless stuff, doesn't it? I wondered this, I saw my mind thinking this in a meditation recently. That guy on NPR that is the announcer for The World, is his name Marco Werman or Mark O'Werman? O'Werman, that's weird. That's like a German-Irish heritage name, and then Mark, like, and then you're just like, oh, and I knew this guy named Mark, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right? Our minds just pinball all over the place. My homeopath said we need to double your dose. So I'm like, does that mean I cut it in half? That goes through my mind on retreat. I'm 63. At age 60, for those of you who don't know this, this is way cool. For $85, you can get a lifetime national park pass to any park. I was psyched. But the woman told me, now, you cannot lose this. I'm like, well, what do you mean? I got a receipt right here. She's like, I know, but you cannot lose this card. If you lose it, you have to buy a new one. I'm like, okay, what kind of sadist designs that for, you know, the senior discount, you know? It's like, to seniors, we're going to give you this card, but we're going to make you do the one thing you can't do, which is never lose it. What kind of sadist? Well, it's the same person, I'm pretty convinced, that named the memory drug that my dog prescribed for me. And it's a 6-syllable name for a memory drug, phosphatidylserine. And so I had to go to the pharmacy. Okay, so show us your ID, fine. And what's your prescription for? Phosphadigadidledigadoodledum? I don't know, phosphat something. Like what sadist named that? I'm just trying to lighten things up, is all. Do you ever notice this on retreat? Your mind has no shame. Joseph Goldstein likes to say that, our teacher, one of our. The mind will go anywhere, think anything about anyone. I was on retreat, I was just like, metta, loving kindness, may all beings be happy. And I was at Spirit Rock, and I was doing walking meditation, and I looked up, and a new yogi had entered retreat, and something about her hairdo, and she had like big, huge glasses, and I just had the most ridiculous judgment. I felt like, who is this person? And like, oh, and may you be happy. And it's like, metta. Or this is a common thing on in retreat culture, you know, someone writes you kind of a note. Well, first of all, you're never supposed to write yogis notes on retreat. But someone had written me a note on retreat, put it on my door saying, would you be willing to close your window, you know, and close your door when you're not in your room because the door is banging? Metta, you know. I'm like, okay, really, metta? You're actually probably really having a lot of aversion. And especially if you're Dave. Sorry, I had to bust out here. We're both aversives. Someone's window's banging during your meditation in your room. God, I can't believe this. So there's a known phenomenon on retreat, which you may know about, called Vipassana Vendetta. And that's where, for some reason, for no reason, you just don't like somebody. It's the way they, like, sprinkle salt on their mashed potatoes. It's the way they walk, you know. It's, you know, for no reason. You watch the mind do this stuff. And then there's the Vipassana romance, known as the VR. So the VV is that. The VR is when, for no reason, there's just something you really like about somebody. And then you're just on retreat, just convinced this is the person you're going to run away with, and you're going to have the whole relationship and marriage and kids. And what's really cool is I had a real Vipassana romance. I met my wife on retreat. not during retreat. I was very good. But after retreat. And my sister-in-law, it's one of her best friends, and she said forever, you and Lisa have a lot in common, you gotta meet. And my sister-in-law figured out that me coming from Vermont and Lisa from Paonia, Colorado, we're gonna be on the same retreat at IMS for a week. So we met afterwards, and she had a few things to work out first, so it took about 2 years. But I gave her my phone number, and we've been together 24 years. Mm-hmm. So there are some real VRs that happen after retreat. So you've probably seen how mindfulness is just everywhere now. Mindful this, mindful that. In the schools, I mean, it's just everywhere. You can even go online. And there's a mindful approach to playing poker. Mindful poker. And I thought, well, that kind of makes sense. We're pretty good at the poker face, us meditators. You know, this is me on retreat, falling madly in love with my wife, Lisa, wife-to-be. Or this is me on a different retreat when, right before, the day before retreat, a week-long retreat, my girlfriend broke up with me. This is me in total heartbreak. We got the poker face down, but what does mindful poker instruction sound like? You know? I invite you to feel your body, you know, as you sip the scotch and savor the warmth, you know? Remember, as you smoke the cigar, just, you can only take one puff at a time. Kind of a culture clash. And now much of our mindfulness is on phones. There's a real culture clash. And definitely, it's very helpful. You know, lots of people learn how to meditate through apps, so I'm not knocking that. But again, phones are the culture where, like, you know, we We can't text okay. We have to text K. And it's like, that's the culture where, like, we'll do our 45-minute sit, but we need to nail it in 10. And recently I saw a book, 51-minute meditations. And I'm like, yep, that's our culture, you know. And yeah, there's a real place for 1-minute meditations. But when I learned to meditate, there were no sitting groups. You had to go on retreat to meditate. And I went on a 2-day retreat. All I remember was knee pain. But I had to have more. There was something about it that really worked for me. Yeah, the teacher was fine. Her name was Pema Chodron. You know, she's kind of a nerdy nun. And talk about pearls before swine. That was my first retreat. So now we can kind of have an instant meditation. You know, used to be you had to really go on retreat to learn. It's kind of funny what we do. So I'm going to switch gears here, and I want to talk about sensory clarity. And sensory clarity is a very important aspect of practice, and I referred to this yesterday on the trail. It's so simple. It's just knowing what sense gate is my experience coming through. Oh, it's a sight. Oh, it's a sound. Oh, it's a thought. Right? So remembering that the sense gate number 6 is the mind. Everything in the mind, everything that's mental is just one sense. And the Buddha called it the all. The totality of our experience is just 6 things. We make it so freaking complicated. But really, when our mind is deeply abiding in awareness and love, thoughts can arise, just like sounds arise, just like sensations arise. And the awake heart doesn't make too big a deal out of the thoughts compared to the other stuff. It's all pretty equalized. So when he says, this is the all, he's really teaching us about balance. He's not saying get rid of the mind in any way. The mind is the portal through which we awaken. Mindfulness is part of the mind, duh. So we don't want to throw it away, but we might want to have a little more balance. Maybe he's suggesting when our practice is strong, that, you know, our thoughts and images are just 1/6 of our experience. I don't know that, but he's definitely saying we need to bring our physical experience much more online. For all the reasons I said yesterday, in a physical experience, and again, if you would, maybe just feel one of your hands right now. Just notice whatever sensations here, or maybe there's multiple sensations, buzz, throb, tingle, warm. And now notice, is there an image of your hand? Just keep feeling, feel the sensation, and notice if there's an image. With sensory clarity, we recognize this. The buzz or throb is physical. The image of the hand is mental. It's actually a mental creation. The sensation in the hand is not. The sensation in the hand is created physically in the body, in our nervous system. And yes, the mind interprets it and all that. So we can't make a completely hard and fast distinction. But it's good enough distinction. Come back to the head now and feel it again. And then notice, are there words, hand or my hand? And they can even be implicit. We can recognize our hand as my hand. We don't need the words to have the thought. Recognize with sensory clarity, this too is mental. We don't have to have the thought, my hand. We don't even have to have the image. Those are optional and they're creations of mind. The pulse, throb, tingle is just the body. That's physical. So sensory clarity is simply assigning everything to its proper gate. And the key distinction is knowing what's physical and what's mental. In that physical experience of hand, throb, or tingle, there's not a me. And you know, this thing of no self in the Buddhist tradition, it's like, it seems so unfathomable. But really, it's very simple experientially. It's recognizing when we can just be in pure hearing or pure feeling the body, even pure seeing, there isn't self-reference in our physical world. The self-reference is only in the mind. The other thing that doesn't exist in that experience of throb or tingle is past or future. It's right here now. The only way to feel the body is in the now. In our physical experience, it's actually timeless. The mind creates time. It creates the thought tomorrow. And there's no tomorrow. It doesn't exist except as a thought. It exists as a thought. Yesterday, it's as gone as the dinosaurs, you know, philosophically. It's as non-existent as everything else in the past. The past doesn't exist except as a thought. So when we drop into the physical experience, all of our five physical senses, we drop out of a separate self and we drop out of time. And separate self plus time equals stress and suffering. Those two ingredients, we project forward and imagine this same me, you know, tomorrow in the rain, and I get stressed. But I'm stressed because my mind is creating these things. But if you were to feel rain physically, it would be wet, it might be cold, but it wouldn't be stress. Our physical body can give us pain, but it doesn't give us stress. Stress is our relationship to pain. The understanding of our tradition is full awakening would be part of full awakening is the ability to experience physical pain with no mental strain. And awakening means, you know, polishing this sixth sense of the mind to more and more use the energy of mind for mindfulness. And yes, we want to use the mind, but we want to replace all of the reactivity in the mind with mindfulness and curiosity. That's really the essence of the Dharma path. is replacing reactivity with curiosity. And then that, if you can apply that to your entire life, your relational issues, you know, health issues, everything. You know, even when we advocate for social justice and for, you know, change in the way we're treating the earth, you know, even that we can advocate from this place of clarity instead of reactivity, from curiosity and learning instead of aggression and reactivity. So sensory clarity is huge, and through it, what we learn how to do is bring our curiosity more to our physical experience. We know we're very curious about our thoughts. I want to just, you know, be lost in my thoughts all day long. Can I be really curious about how it feels, you know, in my body right now? Maybe just feeling the floor or the seat. Could you be really curious, like Dave guided, to notice one full breath? See, on the next in or out breath, can you notice it from beginning to end? We can really start to be more curious about our physical experience, because when we do, we will drop out of separateness and time and stress and into presence, timelessness, and belonging. Why wouldn't we want to inhabit our body more? It has already what we're looking for. And nature is here to support you, you know. So Dave leading that practice of the elements, inner and outer, we're just earth, we're just air, we're just water, we're just fire, temperature. We are the earth. The earth did make us. If we say our allegiance to our mind is about 99% and our physical experience is 1%, I think that's a pretty realistic ratio, then you could double your sensory awareness and you'd still be 98% loyal to your thoughts. You could quadruple your physical awareness and still be 96%. So don't worry. You can do this. You can really, really start to be much more curious about what you're seeing and tasting and feeling and smelling and hearing. So I want to read you a little poem from Mary Oliver called The Summer Day. And she's writing really about sensory experience. And there's two key moves where she really flips her sensory experience. So see if you can hear it. The summer day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who's flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she shifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention. How to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? The poem is cut off. Here it is. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So you may have heard it. She starts out very much caught in the mind. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. And then suddenly she's completely out of her reverie and into what's actually happening. This grasshopper who has flung herself out of the grass, you know, moving her jaws back and forth, gazing around with her enormous eyes. She shifts her pale forearms, she washes her face, she snaps her wings open and floats away. Can you see it all? She's completely in the visual sense. And she's seeing colors. She's seeing the way movement happens. She's very, very in her body. Then she switches again. So now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass. She's saying very clearly, I found my religion. I'm back in my thoughts, but now my thoughts have purpose and meaning and embodiment. My religion is paying attention. My religion is being in my physical senses and seeing things like a grasshopper floating through the sky. So my wish for all of us is that we start being like Mary. Just look, observe, just for the sake of observing, for no other reason. Or sensory clarity. I wanted to speak also about emotions, and so I will try to be brief. I know I've gone on for a while. I just want to give you a little technique for working with emotions. It's kind of my own version of what Michelle McDonald, one of the teachers at Vallecitos, and I think Dave, you've done retreat with her. So she's taught for years at IMS, etc. So she developed this technique called RAIN, and Tara Brach has very much popularized it, but it originally comes from Michelle. And I won't really go through it just because of time, but I'll give you my version of it. It's an acronym for how to be mindful when you're in an emotion. And an emotion, we could say, is really just, you know, thoughts with a strong charge to them. And that charge, the psychic charge, is what magnetizes us into identifying and being lost in our thoughts. The stronger our emotion, the more likely we are to not know we're thinking. To actually think our thought world is the real world, is actually happening. The stronger the emotion, the more likely we're going to be lost in our thoughts. So we need something very simple to help us, and So I nod to Michelle in gratitude, and then I'll kind of give you my version. So just like with RAIN, the R and my acronym is RATA, RATA. So the first thing we want to do with any emotion is to know it's happening. So important. You know, so much, you know, like it's a gift to the world to know what you're feeling and not be lost in it, but still very connected to it, just not lost. So with Rata, we want to recognize. And so just right now, I'll just guide you through this a little bit. Just notice, is there any emotion? And maybe it's a very subtle emotion, like, you know, boredom or interest or, you know, something else. Something more obviously pleasant, like peace or ease. Something unpleasant, restless, averse to tiredness. Whatever it is, recognize it and just name it. Just silently make a note of it. And then the second step, A, is to allow or accept. Let whatever's here be here. And the best simple little phrase I know to help the allowing is to just say, of course. Okay, so whatever's here that you're aware of, even if it's just a very subtle mind state, just say, of course. And so the I of RAIN is investigate, but I don't really use that in the acronym, but it is what we do. And what we're going to do is investigate by feeling the body. With our emotions, we pay attention to the body because it's present moment and it's not nearly as charged as the thoughts. So whatever the emotion is, we want to acknowledge the thoughts. Just the basic simple story is all you need. I feel this way, I feel that way. And then the rest of our interest goes to body. Does this state of mind manifest in the body as sensation? And it may not. So if it doesn't, just feel breath. Keep being physical. But if there is sensation obvious in the body, what we're doing is we're turning towards the experience in the body. So we recognize, we name it, we allow. So we just say, of course. And then the T stands for towards in the body. We turn towards wherever it might be in the body. And then we just notice, what's it like? What sensation is here? And it's very important to just turn towards it. So this first step in our interests is to feel what it's like in the body. For instance, if there were anxiety, you would be then maybe noticing something like fluttery in the belly. As we stay curious, we can notice where the sensation is not where the emotion is not expressing in the body. So even if I were anxious and I notice fluttering in the belly, I might notice if I go back towards the spine, there's not flutter. Or lower body may not be flutter, or back. So whatever sensation you're with right now, we've turned towards it. Now you want to turn away, and that's the fourth letter of A. A stands for away in the body. So now, notice everything else in the body. So this is a very simple technique for being aware of any emotion. Four steps: recognize, allow, towards in the body, away in the body. If you can do this, the kindness I find built in with the of course. That's like a, almost like a grandparent. Just saying of course, you know. There's always a reason for whatever we're feeling. So the of course just really helps it settle in, whatever it is. And so this is our way of being really open-hearted with whatever our emotion is, while not getting swept away by it or lost in it. We can feel it more fully because we have this kind of safety of being in the body. Because again, the body's present moment. All the drama's in the story. To be mindful of it, you don't need all the huge story. You just need the basic headline. So the story can happen, but you can keep redirecting to body. So there's a very profound insight, two really profound insights that happen when we bring mindfulness to emotions. The first is, if I can keep paying kind attention, emotions come and go. If I'm not fueling it, the story, by kind of throwing more logs on the fire just burns itself out over time. You know, some scientific studies, I don't know the exact numbers, how long do emotions last? You know, the numbers are typically 15, 20 seconds, something like that. But that's really only if you're not fueling them. If we're fueling them, they can last a lot longer, of course. And this is the insight of impermanence. Oh, if I'm not in reaction to or feeding the emotion, it actually kind of metabolizes itself. And I like to say emotion is, you know, the word emotion is just E followed by motion. And I think an emotion is, the E stands for energy. So an emotion, when we're not lost in it, is energy that wants to move. And it will, if you can just keep paying attention. So you keep showing up with it, you turn towards, then you turn away, then you come back, you turn towards again, and you turn away. So that's a very important insight. And we start to feel my experience is workable. My emotions come and go. They really are energy that wants to move. And if our emotions are workable, the world is workable. The Tibetan tradition calls it this lion's roar of confidence when we start to feel our heart is workable. And then, just very briefly, and then I'll end. The other insight that comes about, if I were feeling anxiety and I noticed flutter in the belly, but the rest of the body pretty calm, then the language, I am scared, does not track my experience. That's identifying with the emotion. That's typically what we do. Our language reflects how lost we get in our emotions. If we're aware of an emotion, then our language of anxiety might be more like, there's anxiety in a part of me, or anxiety is known. That language tracks our experience more. So this is the insight of non-identification. We get it. Any emotion I'm having is not me, because it's not all of my experience. There's other things happening. So that's why Ratha really helps you with that. When you turn towards in the body and then away in the body, you can start to realize, oh, there's anger, and wow, there's clenching in the fists. The shoulders are up and tight. Maybe there's clenched in the jaw. But lower body, just relaxed. Not much sensation. So then I'm angry. That doesn't track. There's an anger in a part of me. That tracks. And it's very helpful to not be identified with what you're feeling. Okay. I will stop there. Thank you for your very patient and kind attention. Let's just sit for a moment. So let's just stand up and walk a little bit, just for about 10 minutes. So it's at 8:30. And now, is there a bell ringer? Probably at this time. What time are you supposed to ring?
8:05.
Okay. maybe in 5 minutes, if you would, Brad, ring the bell. And then, so at 8:25, and then we'll be back here at 8:30 for our last sit together.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.